There she stood at the gate. The gate of a massive educational institution. The new case in her hand. And tears kind of welling up inside. Excited and nervous because she'd been looking forward to it for the whole summer. Feeling very grown up. But at the same time, strangely feeling very little, very tiny and insignificant, and quite unready for it. And as she stood there at the gate, with people whirring around, all firing off in this direction and that direction, suddenly immobilised by the uncertainty of it all, by the big buildings that are there, by the older people who all seem to know what they're doing, and all seem so confident. Very unsure of which way to go to, which door to walk at to, which, what to do. And the tears that were there right behind the eyeballs slowly start to creep out. And then they flow down the cheeks and the sobbing starts. And my daughter commences infant school again. She is a great symbol of modern man in his lostness. For she has come of age to rule the world, but can't tie up her own shoelaces. And many of us start, and start an institution such as this one, with exactly that same kind of feeling that we had when we first kicked off an infant school. It's not just that we're lost geographically, trying to find one building or another, and one lecture room and another, but we're lost in that we're lonely. We're being pressured from all sides, and we're unsure, and we're insecure about where we should be going, and what we should be doing, and whether we can make it, and how we do it, and where do we go. And which Christian group should we be involved in, as much as anything else? For there seems to be so much going on all around about us, and everybody else seems to know what they're doing, and nobody's actually making it clear to me, or rather everybody's trying, and it's just getting more confusing. And so we search to try and find out who are we, where do we fit, to whom do I relate in this massive organisation. If I know where to fit in my social relationships, I may be able to find some perspective on who I am and how valuable I am and how worthwhile and all those kinds of questions. So one of the big questions is, who is the boss and who is my equal? And if it's possible when you start, who is my inferior? How is the line of command worked out? What help is offered to a newcomer, and how do I get to know people, and who do I get to know, and on what basis can I get to know them? How soon will it be before I'm introduced to the Vice Chancellor? And how many weeks after that will it be before I receive a letter inviting me to become the next Vice Chancellor? Who am I? Yet the strange kind of feeling of alienation that we may have, the insecurities, is bigger than just the social relationships that we do or do not establish in any context. Because starting off at uni is like starting off at infant school. You start at infant school, you gradually get your confidence up, and when you really know what you're doing, they stick you into primary school and you start all over again, don't you? And when you get up to sixth class and you're running the school, then they whack you into high school, and it's just as terrifying as it was back in infant school. And when you finally conquered that, then they put you into university, and it's bigger and even more terrifying. And when you actually conquer that, or are conquered by it, they put you out to work. And when you finally reach the giddy heights of 60, they put you into retirement. And that change is just too much of a shock to recover from, because most men die in the first 12 months of it. And their widows go on a tour with the Women's Weekly. Now, the kinds of insecurities I have, which I seek to answer in my social relationships, don't really in the long run answer my problem, because my social relationships keep changing. The order of command keeps changing, the boss keeps changing, everything keeps changing in this changeable world, and we find modern men are actually expressing a lostness that goes beyond just social relationships. A lostness of who are we, what are we doing, why are we? Why are we doing what we're doing? You see it in the literature they're writing. You see it in the drama, in the theatre of the absurd. That's what it's about. You see it in modern art. And the kinds of questionings and the kinds of hopeless despair that is being communicated as to why are we doing what we're doing, and who am I, and who is in control of this nightmare of a situation? Or even, is there anybody in control in this world? And you read Kafka and you read Camus and some of those boys, and you get the distinct impression that nobody is in control. And that is what makes it all so nightmarish. And that's why we don't continue on to English when we get to university, because we've had enough of that stuff. But it's a real question that modern man in his lostness does not seem to be able to answer as to who am I. Now, the Book of Revelation is the happy hunting ground of all true heretics. If you want to be a heretic, Revelation is just your stuff. Because all the religious nuts I've ever met have quoted to me the Book of Revelation. And I may say, in my line of business, I have met more than my fair share of religious nuts. They love it because it gives them such freedom. Such freedom to speculate in so many areas of life without the slightest controls of facts or evidence. You see, if you've ever stayed home on a Sunday morning instead of going to church, I'm sure that you have been visited by the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they always call on Sunday mornings, they don't have to bother with the church people there. But if you've been home any other time of the day, you've most likely met up with them. And if you can get them off the subject of Jesus, which they're only too glad to get off the subject of, you will discover that the thing they quote most is the Book of Revelation. And because you don't know the first thing about the Book of Revelation, or worse still, you have the slightest piece of knowledge about it, when they quote this verse to you, it sounds exactly what they say it's meaning. And you don't know what it's about, and you can't work all the symbols out about, and you just say, yeah, well, I'm Presbyterian, goodbye. I mean, that is the one all true answer, because even if you're Presbyterian, there cannot be anything wrong, can there? Have you ever met a Presbyterian Jehovah's Witness? Well, there you go, you see? So you have solved the problem, haven't you, of the Book of Revelation at least once. And all the heretics, they all work out of the Book of Revelation. I've got a book at home which is a fascinating one, really. It's of a conversion of a Jehovah's Witness to the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And in it is recounted the blow-by-blow detailed description of the Seventh-day Adventist evangelism of a Jehovah's Witness, all of which comes out of the Book of Revelation. And it is fascinating because I can't understand either of their theories about the Book of Revelation, yet alone work out which one's right and why. Although, this man did. Now, I think you've got to be careful on the Book of Revelation. It is a great problem, really, that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. You see, it was Calvin that said that the Book of Revelation finds every man mad or leaves him that way. Calvin wrote commentaries in every book of the Bible except for Esther, because it didn't have the mention of God, and the Book of Revelation, because he thought it just produced madness. C.H. Spurgeon says, the man who says he can understand the Book of Revelation is a madman. That doesn't give you great courage, does it? It is a book, though, that moderns are fascinated by. Not all moderns, but many of them are. And I suspect that it's got to do with two things, really, two ungodly things. One is the desire to know the future, to actually know what is going to take place. You see verse 1 there? It's all about what must soon take place. And modern man is fascinated to know the future. Not only the Alvin Toffler kind of futurology, the astrologists too. It's a desire that if I know what the future holds, then I might be able to accommodate my life for it, I might be able to be in control of this world, if I just knew what the future held. And here is a book that tells me what the future is about. Therefore, this is the book for me. And it's that love of being in control of the future that gives men the fascination for Revelation. It is also, I think, to be a little bit ruder to you, because in your fellowship group you've most likely studied Revelation 25 times to the confusion of everybody, it's also because people dislike the simple, clear directives of the rest of Scripture. Now, you read Paul, it's all black and white. It's clear what you're to do and why you're to do it, and how guilty you are and how you need to resolve that problem. But you read the Book of Revelation, and you can think whatever you want to think. You can run the world any way you want to run the world. You can make the symbols mean blue, green, yellow, or red. It doesn't matter. You become God when you read the Book of Revelation, because of the very nature of the book. Now, while there is this fascination for it, not everybody really likes it like that. I actually was trying to talk a man into coming to Bible study earlier this week. I hope he's not here, but if he is, well, he'll know the truth of what I'm saying. I tried to talk him into it, and I was saying, look, you should come to Bible study. And he said, oh, I don't know about that. I said, well, you haven't been to a Bible study? And he said, well, I used to go to church regularly. I said, oh, that's good. And which church was that? And he said, no, I won't mention it, because some of you are here. And he said, such and such a church. And I said, oh, good, good. That's not a bad church to go to. Why don't you go there now? He says, oh, no. He says, no, what they do is dull all the time. I wouldn't want to go to that kind of thing. And I said, well, studying the Bible's not dull. He said, oh, what's the way they do it? And I said, really, why? He said, well, All they ever studied was the book of Revelation. So I said, well, why don't you come to us in second session? Because lose your punchline a little bit on that, don't you? Here is a man who is thoroughly sick of it. Now, part of the reason he's sick of it is because of the nature of the book, that being of a symbolic nature, it is full of difficulties. It's not simple, it's not straightforward, and it is not easy. It has a special style of writing called Jewish apocalyptic literature, which had its own particular style of symbols. And symbols are very ambiguous. They're not straightforward. I mean, words have got their ambiguities, but symbols are much more ambiguous. One of a good friend of mine who's a clergyman was dealing with a lady. I've forgotten the details of why he was dealing with her. He's giving her instructions on which train to catch or something like that, just in the street. And there he was, a clergyman, in his clerical collar and all the rest of it. And he gave her these instructions. At the end of it, she said, oh, thank you very much. And pointing to his fish pad, said, I'm a Pisces too. And walked off. Now, there is a small problem, isn't it? He, being well trained in the Greek language, used the fish to mean ichthus, which is all about Jesus. She, being not versed, I suppose, at all in the Latin language, used it to mean Pisces, which has got to do with astrology, which is fundamentally opposed to ichthus and Jesus. The one symbol means such too radically. Now, the book of Revelation is full of symbols. A white horse appears. What does a white horse mean to you? Does it mean the same thing as it does to Bart Cummings? I doubt it very strongly. Now then, what are you going to do with symbols? I'm going to try and interpret them through Jewish Old Testament route. Because it seems to me it's written as a Jewish writing, Jewish Christian writing, and it quotes the Old Testament left, right and centre and makes all kinds of allusions to the Old Testament. I can't give them to you all. Time would not allow that, but that's how I'm coming to my understanding of the symbols, and I'm happy for you to examine me and ask me questions about it any time you like, or come along in the question times and ask the questions then. I don't always answer the questions there, by the way, especially if they're about calculus and other things. Now, which I can't. The other thing is to buy a good commentary, and we're commending this one, and we've got many more copies than just the half dozen here, but we're commending this one, which is at $6, well, that one's $7.45, the one I had yesterday was $6.95. Yeah, this one's $6.95, and that's $7.45. Yeah. I don't know what that is symbolic of, I'll have to work that out later. It's a good commentary because it's readable. That's a great help on the book of Revelation, because most of them are totally unreadable. It's sane, that is considerably a great help. He actually tells you what he doesn't understand, which is an indication that he's not a madman, according to Spurgeon. See, he doesn't understand it all. It's also helpful because he sets out for you the alternative views. Right? Just doesn't propose his own view. He sets out the alternatives, and my understanding, he sets them out fairly, too. And furthermore, he tells you which one he believes and why he believes it. So you know his bias, and you can take account of that when he sets out his alternative views. That's a very helpful little commentary. I don't know any other one that does it quite so neatly as that. And while I agree with most of his thesis, I disagree with bits of it too, and I'm happy to share with you that my disagreement, he doesn't know that I disagree with him, but I can't expect anyone to agree with anyone's commentary on the Book of Revelation, but I found that most helpful, I'm sure you will, and one of the beauties of it, Michael Wilcock on I Saw the Heaven Opened, is that he actually tries to apply it to our lives and not just leave it as a detached speculation. It's a very valuable little commentary. It's only come out in the last couple of years, and we'll be selling it each week up here, but you can get copies of it down in the chaplaincy. And that would help you to sort it out. One of the great problems, though, when it comes to the difficulties in understanding the book of Revelation, and divides Christians, has got to do with the time sequence. So let me come clean about that now. The big division occurs on the subject of the millennium. There are those who are premillennialists, and there are those who are postmillennialists, and those who are amillennialists and those who are panmillennialists who believe that it will all pan out in the end anyway. Now, you will notice that the subject of the millennium comes up in chapter 20. And you will notice that we're not going anywhere that far, because I'm not that silly. However, the answers that are necessary will come out in the first couple of verses, because the time sequence is spelled out right there when it talks about what must soon take place and because the time is near. So without giving myself a label as to which school I'm in, let me tell you what I believe about the return of the Lord from the start, and then you'll understand my prejudices if you understand the differences. And if you don't, blessed and holy are you, buy a copy of the book, it's in there. I believe that Jesus has conquered sin and Satan at the cross of Calvary and in his resurrection, and that he will return sometime soon. When I do not know, but soon, sometime. He will return, for there is nothing more to happen. For the end of the ages has come upon us who live in this Christian era. There is nothing more to happen because Satan has been overthrown, sin has been paid for, death has been conquered. It's all happened. All that needs to be done is the mop-up operation of the return of Jesus. When he will do that is, of course, a great fascination to our pagan minds. But the New Testament refuses ever to give us a date. Rather, it gives us an attitude. Soon, near, close by, suddenly, like a thief in the night, when you least expect it. That is when he will return. That is all you need to know to live a godly life. You do not need to know the date. In fact, having the date most likely would not help you to live a godly life, especially for many months before the date arrived. It would help you on the day, I'm sure, but it wouldn't help you on many other days. But the knowledge that it's soon, near, sudden, that helps you to be godly, and that you are told. That attitude is based on the fact of the gospel. And so it is the basic Christian attitude. Jesus is in heaven, and he will soon return. And that is what is being revealed to us here, I believe, what must soon take place. And so he says at the end of verse 3, because the time is near. See, let's get back onto the track of Revelation for a moment in that title of verses 1 to 3. The revelation is an unveiling. It's not a discovery. We do not discover the things of God. He reveals them to us. You see, what is written here on this blackboard? No, not this one, the one behind. You do not know, do you? And so I can unveil it for you. Nothing is written on that blackboard. I have revealed to you a nothing. And when it is hidden, though, it is you're unable to know. Now, you don't learn it from discovery. You learn it from someone showing it to you. So it is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. But when you say what must soon take place, you are expecting me now to chronicle out, well, next year such and such will happen, the year after so and so, then when those things have happened, this will happen. But it needn't be like that at all. Indeed, I'd suggest to you it's not. Let me show you the magnificence of my artwork as a graduate in arts. Geography, in fact. And certainly wasn't fine art. Now, there you go. There is a happy man, isn't he? Very happy man. Let me show you what must soon take place to this happy man. Now, in case you didn't know, it's a hammer. Now, I am not actually recounting for it ball by ball, I'm just showing you what is the state. Before you had the picture of a hammer, it was veiled. The reality of life was veiled. All you saw was the man. But then suddenly I reveal to you what was above his head in the process of falling. And you realize what must soon take place. I'm not giving you, I actually haven't shown it lodging into the skull. I haven't shown that, have I? I don't need to show that. I've shown you what the present state is. And once you understand the present state, then you know what must soon take place, don't you? Once you see Jesus, the conquering king of the universe, who has overcome sin, Satan, death, then you know what must soon take place. The judgment of the world. That one must soon take place. And you're not actually always being shown the process of the judgment, though sometimes you are. Sometimes you're just being shown Jesus where he is. And like the hammer, you know what's going to happen next. It's quite clear. So it is a revelation. It's a revealing, it's a showing of what the real situation is. Now next week in chapters 1, we'll look at chapters 1 to 3, the whole 3 chapters. Today is only 8 verses. The whole 3 chapters next week to look at the Jesus letters, to put the famous 7 letters, to the letters of the 7 churches in their right context. And then the week after we'll look at those, only I've got a better title than the letter to the 7 churches. We're going to call it the show cause letters, because that is what they are about. And those of us who know the feeling will know the letters well. Today, though, we've only got a chance to look at this marvellous little prologue, which sets the scene for the whole book. Verses 1 to 8 is the prologue. Sets the scene for the whole book. Its structure is simple. Verses 1 to 3 is the title, and I've already said all that I'm going to be saying about those in the introductory comments so far. And then verses 4 and 5 are the greeting that John sends to the 7 churches. And then verses 5b to 8 is the ascription of glory to Jesus. One other little symbol I need to pick up on today, and I'm sorry, I must have missed it out of my notes when I read it down. That is the symbol 7. There's only one symbol that's relevant today, and that's number 7. We think of 7 not non-symbolically, but without it, with mathematically. That is, we think of it as the square root of 49. We think of it as halfway between 6 and 8. That is the kind of things that we don't think about it any other way than that. But if you're going to start using symbols, then colours, animals, numbers are good things to do symbols with. And the ancient world was big on symbols, and one symbol that the Jewish world was very big on was the number 7. And there's very little doubt or controversy about the number 7, because it is so widely used to symbolise perfection, completeness, totality, the whole of something, the essence of something, the real thing. So that when he writes to 7 churches of Asia, it's not because there are only 7 churches in Asia, there are many more than that, but I take it he's writing to all the churches, the whole church. If you put those 7 together, you get the church. More of that next week when we come on to the 7 letters to the churches. But you'll also notice when it speaks about the 7 spirits of God, this is no new doctrine discovered in the last book of the Bible, that it turns out there's God the Father, God the Son, and God's 7 spirits as well. I'm saying the whole spirit, the spirit of God, the real spirit of God, is being referred to. Okay, let us then look at this, and we won't follow the structure of the passage, but rather go back to the question of who am I? Who is Jesus? What has he done? And where do I fit in with him? Are the questions we're really looking at now. Who is Jesus, and what has he done, so that I can understand who I am and where I fit in with him? Last little comment about the introduction occurs in verse 3, that is, that there is a great blessing in the activity we're engaged in. You notice that? That he who reads it, that's Peter because he read it for us, and he who listens, who hears it, and takes it to heart, there is blessing promised from God. Now, there's a great blessing in reading the Bible always. But this part of the Bible gives you a special promise of a blessing, and I think I need it because I'm terrified of doing the whole activity. I don't want to teach this passage. In fact, it's the first time I've ever taught Revelation. Always avoided it. Yet God gives me a special promise that if you teach this one, if you live by this one, there is a special blessing from him for the activity. Now, therefore, can I encourage you to keep doing it, keep working at it, keep coming and hearing it read and keep reading it out, that we might actually get to know what the book of Revelation says, because there is a blessing of God in that. There's two things about that I'd like to point out. One is the blessing is not a magical system. God doesn't look down from heaven and say, hey, look, they've got it on the book of Revelation. I've got them covered. Some magic has now taken place. We've all been zotted because we actually happen to have the Bible fall open on Revelation. It's not like that. It's got to do with the fact that if you study this book, then this book will have a message that will transform your life, will bring God's blessings into your life. And so who gets the blessing? It's the one not just who hears it, but who takes it to heart, who lives by it, who wants to be obedient to what the message is that's here. If you read and understand this book, your life will be blessed by it. That's a great challenge for us, really. That actually makes this more important than anything else we do at university, really. It's true of the whole Bible, it's especially true of the book of Revelation, that if we can really grasp hold of it, it will have a transforming effect upon us. Exciting news to know that, and I'm sure it's real, and we will discover it in the doing of it. Those of us who want to be obedient, who want to live by it, who want to take it to heart. The second thing I'd say about that is, haven't you got friends? Wouldn't you like them to have the blessings of God? There are just a few spare seats here still. But we have it on Fridays and Tuesdays in this lecture theatre, and Wednesday down in the chaplaincy. It's full in the chaplaincy on Wednesday, so would you mind inviting your friends to come on Tuesday or Friday, or to fill in with you here on Thursday, that they may share also in the blessings of God as we study the book of Revelation and encourage each other to live by it. Well, now let's turn to who is he. For there are remarkable remarks made after the title about who Jesus is. For when John sends the greeting of grace and peace, when John sends the greeting, he does so from Jesus, and then he ascribes to Jesus power and glory. For John wishes Jesus to have power and glory forever and ever for all ages. That power and glory are the things that kings have, the might to rule and the magnificence that comes with owning everything. And it's something that we rarely wish for anybody other than ourselves. And certainly we don't wish it for all time. The people of Australia wished it for Malcolm Fraser in November last year. But nobody I know of wished it to him for all time. Most people were willing to give it to him begrudgingly because they didn't like the alternative, for 3 years unless we can get him to resign before then. Unless your name happens to be Fraser, I suppose. You may have wanted him for longer than that. But we don't actually wish all power and glory to you, Malcolm, forever and ever. Nor to any king, prime minister, governor, general, or premier I've ever heard of. But that is what John is wanting for Jesus. Why? Well, because in verses 4 and 5, it is Jesus who is the source of grace and peace together with God and God's Spirit. That's not bad company to keep, is it? You know, who are the two people that you work with? Well, I work with God and His Spirit. That is very good company. The Jesus we're dealing with is someone of enormous importance in the spectrum of the universe. God and His Spirit He works with in sending grace and peace to people. And who is He who does these things? Well, three things are said of Him, aren't they? That He is the faithful witness, all in verse 5 there, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth. He is the one who combines with God and with the Spirit to send grace and peace to people. What do they mean? Well, the faithful witness is a phrase that can be well taken out of the life of Jesus in John's Gospel. Jesus is the one who bore testimony, and bore testimony even though it meant He was executed for it. How do I know that? Well, John chapter 18 records for us the interview between Pontius Pilate and Jesus. It was because Jesus was stuck to His guns on that occasion that Jesus was executed. But what did He bear witness about? Well, Jesus says, I have come into the world, John 18:37, I have come into the world to bear witness to the truth. And because of that, He was executed, you see. And you say, yeah, well, what is the truth? Did they like saying that? Well, you're in bad company, friends, because that's exactly what Pontius Pilate asked you. What is truth? What is the truth that Jesus comes to bear witness about? About God? About God and His relationship with man? About Himself. For He is the truth. He bore witness to Himself and to God, and to man being able to relate to God through Himself. And He bore such witness so faithfully that He didn't budge from it, even though they killed Him. A faithful witness is a way of talking about the life and work of Jesus. The firstborn of the dead is a phrase that talks about the resurrection of Jesus, because it is in His resurrection that He becomes the firstborn of the dead. Not just that He is the first to rise from the dead, though that may be true, but that He becomes the heir of the dead. For the phrase firstborn means the heir. Comes to have that connotation. How? Well, it's because it originally meant the one born first, obviously. But the one born first was the one who was the heir. In our society, in our family, or my family, I presume it's this way, especially as I'm the third born, I presume it's this way, that the inheritance is going to be divided in equal portions for each member of the family. I haven't checked up with Dad about that. But in the ancient world, it is the firstborn who receives everything, and the subsequent children are pensioned off, or put into the army, or put into the church, or sent to the colonies. Now, that ancient world practice is still portrayed some places. I mean, the royal family is part of the ancient world, and it does that. It's like Prince Charles gets everything, and Edward and Andrew and Anne get pensioned off to country estates, with or without horses. Now, Charles is the firstborn. He is the heir of all. He may not have been born first. You see, Anne, if Anne was older than he would still be the firstborn, because he'd still be the heir. Chauvinism still reigns in the British Empire at that point. But it's the first male who inherits all, and so becomes the firstborn. Jesus is the firstborn of what? Of the dead. That is, of the world to come, as well as the world now. He is the ruler, the owner, the heir, of the living and the dead, of the other world. And so he's in the third title, which is a much easier, more straightforward one to grasp hold of, that he is the ruler of the kings of the earth. This speaks of his present exaltation. So mighty and magnificent is Jesus, that he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings, the ruler of the princes of the universe. He is the one who runs the world, who owns it, who is the heir of it, and the ruler and king of it. Flip with me to chapter 17, verse 14. Chapter 17, verse 14. It says there of the Lamb that He is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. See that there? Turn over to chapter 19 then. Chapter 19. And is it verse 16? On his robe and on his thigh he had his name written. What's his name? King of Kings. Lord of Lords. He is the ruler of the universe. All those three things, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth, can be found in Psalm 89 about the Messiah. But the dramatic and incredible thing to think about for a moment, though, is who is this Jesus? Who is the King of Kings? Because in the Old Testament, there's only one King of Kings, there's only one ruler of rulers, there's only one Lord of Lords, and that's God. God is the King of Kings, and the Lord of Lords, and the ruler of rulers. So who's Jesus? The answer comes even further, because in verse 7, there is a sudden transformation of a passage. It makes a big jump. And John says, look. Look at what you can see. It's one of those occasions when the curtain is ripped back and I say, look, there it is. And he's got more to see than I've just shown you. You'll be glad to know. What is it that he sees? He sees, it's Daniel 7:13 and it's Zechariah 12:10. And you say, ripper, marvellous. Well, you should. Because that is what his next says. Verse 7 of chapter 1 is just a combination of Daniel 7:13 and Zechariah 12:10. Big deal! Oh, my friend, you're ignorant of the Bible if you don't think it's a big deal, because Daniel 7:13 is all about the Son of Man. The Son of Man who comes in the clouds. He is the ruler of the universe, the Son of Man. I'm now at this point going to go into an interpretation which you don't find in any of the commentaries, and therefore I warn you of that so that you won't get misled. I won't find it. I'm sure it's right. I wouldn't give it to you if I didn't think so. And it's not original to me, but it's just you find it in some articles. Nearly everyone takes this as the second coming. I don't think it's got anything to do with the second coming. Well, not, it's got something to do, but I don't think it's about the second coming. Because when you go back to Daniel 7, you find that the Son of Man coming in the clouds is a particular phrase with a particular meaning. You see, the picture in Daniel 7 is that of the great judgment day. When the Ancient of Days sits on his throne and the court of the universe is set up and he makes his judgment, the books are opened up, and then one like the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days and is given power and glory and authority to rule over all nations, all kingdoms, for all time, everywhere, forever. That is the Son of Man. He is the ruler of the universe, given that by God. John says, look, there is the Son of Man. There he is. It's a big deal he's saying here. I mean, he's not just ripping down a blackboard and saying, look, it's blank. He's actually opening up the heavens and saying, look, there he is, the ruler of the universe. That is who he is proclaiming at this point. Why is it different? It's not the second coming, it seems to me, because when he comes, he doesn't come down to heaven. The picture's not about, he doesn't come down to earth, rather. The picture's not about the earth with the Son of Man coming down to the earth. The picture is about heaven, with the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days. That's what that is going up. When you see the Son of Man coming in the clouds, when you see him in his heavenly splendor, sitting at the right hand of God in all power and authority, check out Stephen. He sees him just before they kill, before he was killed, in chapter 7 of Acts. The Son of Man sitting in the right hand, standing at the right hand of God in all power and authority and might. That is who we see. Daniel 7. And John is saying, I see Jesus, the Son of Man, in power in heaven. And you say, this is marvellous news. And then he says, yes, but look at him, and what do you see? The Son of Man who rules the world? He's got holes in his hands and his feet, and his side has been pierced. And when everybody sees him whom they have pierced, they will not shout for joy, but they will mourn and weep and lament. And every eye will see him, and even those who pierced him, and all the people of the earth will mourn because of him. Here is a quote from Zechariah chapter 12. It's again a picture of judgment in Zechariah 12. God has just overthrown his enemies in verses 1 to 9. And all the people are joyful. And just as their joy reaches its climax, suddenly the news comes that they look on the one whom they have pierced. And they mourn. All the nations mourn. One after another mourn. For the one that they have pierced. The Holy One of God, indeed in Zechariah, it always sounds like God himself, has been somehow struck down and murdered by the people. And so the people, in the moment of their joy, see what they have done, and they mourn. And God forgives them and restores them in chapter 13 of Zechariah. That is the picture that comes here. But as we see the Son of Man, the ruler of the universe, the King of Kings, the firstborn from the dead, we see that he is the one that we killed, that we murdered. And we realize the appalling horror of what we have done. Here are two contradictory figures in the Old Testament. The ruling King of the universe and the pierced sufferer. Struck down. No one ever put those two ideas together because they're just completely different ideas. They didn't know who these two people were. There's lots of speculation in intertestamental writings amongst the Jewish community as to who they were. No one ever put them together until Jesus does in Matthew chapter 24, verse 30. And Jesus says that the Son of Man is the one who is the executed, pierced one of Zechariah 12. And John sees it there. And it is an extraordinary putting together of ideas. For it means the king has become king through execution. You see it in the Gospel of Jesus, in Mark's Gospel, that his crucifixion is his coronation. Great rumours abroad now. They might actually get around to giving Charles the Empire, the Commonwealth, the British Isles, or whatever else is left over. They're going to crown him. Yes, Charles would be a bit excited about such a prospect. I guarantee he doesn't think they're going to do it by crucifying him. That is the most bizarre way of setting up a king, isn't it? That is how Jesus comes to his kingdom. And so when you see who is in control of the universe, you see it as the one who killed. When you realize that it's the one that you killed and I killed, then you mourn because I was so stupid as to drive the nails in. Sticking with a spear. I was face to face with the author of life and so I killed him. I was face to face with my ruler and my judge, so I blew him up. And there he stands. But there's more to those wounds than that. The voice comes from heaven, I am the Alpha and the Omega. And now you don't know if it's God or it's Jesus. Because the Alpha and the Omega is used both of God and of Jesus. In chapter 1, verse 17, it's quite clear it's Jesus who is the first and the last. In chapter 22, Jesus says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, who was and is to come. Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega. God is the Alpha and the Omega. Jesus is the ruler of the universe. God is the ruler of the universe. Jesus is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. God is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Who do you think Jesus is? You don't have to be super bright to make the jump at that point, do you? That you're really dealing here with God himself. When you deal with Jesus. That is who you can see. And when you see your God, what do you see? You see where you stabbed him. You see where you killed him. You see where you executed him. How did I do that? Well, it's by his grace that has come to you. But look at the King and I. He is the source of grace. He is the one who gives forgiveness and peace and mercy. And how? Well, it comes out in that phrase there in verse 6. Verse 5, to him, the description bit, to him who loves us and freed us from our sins by his blood and has made us to be a kingdom and priests to serve his God and Father, to him be glory and power forever and ever. You see, this king has freed us for he loves us. He goes on loving us, but he has taken a deliberate action to free us on one occasion. He has freed us from what? From our captivity. You didn't know you were in prison. Yes, you are in prison, as I am in prison. But Jesus has actually stepped in and freed us from that captivity. What is the prison we are in? It's slavery to sin. He said in chapter 8 of the Gospel of John, anyone who sins is a slave of sin. We're all born into slavery. And the slavery we're born into is death row. We sit in our prison in death row. And you say, but I don't feel like I'm in prison. I'm a free man. I can walk around my cell all day. But that's where we are. We're in our cell. Oh, come on. That's a bit much. It's not. I don't want to be selfish. I don't want to be greedy. I don't want to be lying. I don't want to be covetous. I don't want to be... But I'm always good. And the thing I found about other humans is exactly the same. I want to be generous. I want to be kind. I want to be truthful. But I'm not always generous, I'm not always kind, I'm not always truthful. Does it sound like I'm in control of myself? No. When the good things I want, I don't do, and the bad things I don't want to do, I race in headlong, it doesn't sound like I've got much control over myself, does it? Sounds like somebody else is helping run the ship here, doesn't it? I'm a slave to the very sin, and I'm a slave in another way too. I'm in bondage to death, a punishment to sin. Is there anybody in this room who thinks they're not sitting in death row? Well, we can put the same question another way, less dramatically. Is anybody here not going to die? No? You're all going to die? Well, where do you think you're sitting? In death row. It might be a long time, it might be a short time, but the gallows lies for all of us one time. That is the nature of this life we're in, and we're here because of sin. But Jesus has freed us, he's sprung us. How? By ripping open the gates? By saying, oh, sin doesn't matter? No, not at all. By going to the gallows on our behalf. And actually going down the end of death row and taking it for us. And that's what those wounds are that we see in the Son of Man. The execution marks of my execution that he has taken on my behalf. That is why I killed him, even though I wasn't born 2,000 years ago, even though I wasn't a Roman soldier or a Jew. I don't have to do those things. I killed him because it was because of me that he was executed. And that is what I will see. And when I mourn that I have done that to my God, that's why the peoples of the world will mourn. But it is through that execution that I can be freed, but my friends, if you ever are in prison and someone offers to spring you, make sure what they're going to do with you when you get outside. One thing to get out, it's another thing to get home. And what's home like when you get there? What has he freed us from? From the slavery to sin, yes. What has he freed us for? To become kings and priests of God. That's what he's freed us for. To be a kingdom and to be priests. And you'll find if you check out later, chapter 5, verse 10, write it down, check it up later, chapter 5, verse 10, it's not just to be a kingdom, it's actually to be kings, to rule with him. There was a slight giggle when I said earlier that you didn't know how long it would take you to meet the vice-chancellor or how long it would take you to actually become vice-chancellor. You know, it's frustrating, a lifetime, and there's only a vague possibility. There's a bigger transformation in life that takes place for everyone who's a Christian. Because you move from being a slave to being the king in a moment. That's bigger than from undergraduate to vice-chancellor. And that's only a little jump compared to moving from slavery to kingship. As not only that one, there's another one that goes with it. You move from being a slave to sin to being a priest of God in a moment. All Christians are the rulers of the world with Jesus and the priests of God under the great high priest Jesus. All Christians. There is no group of Christians that are priests. That's a load of nonsense, that, of course. Every Christian is a priest. Every Christian is a king. You see what Jesus has done for me? He has transformed my social standing, my eternal social standing, as radically as you could possibly ever be transformed. Out of the bondage of sin and death, into being the ruler of the world with him in eternity, and a priest to God to serve my God in holiness and righteousness all the days of my life. And how has he done that? By his blood. And when I see him, will I not mourn that I should have forced him to do that? Will I not mourn because he loves me so much that that has taken the place? Once I perceive Jesus, then I actually start to perceive who I am, where I am, what I'm about, where I'm going. Once that curtain is ripped apart, and I see who is actually standing at the right hand of God in all power and authority. And I see him with the scars in his hands and his feet in his side. Then I can grasp hold of who I am. And why I am. And where I'm going. And so the question that this study puts to us are twofold. One, who do you think Jesus is? That's a big issue. Big question. You may not know. Please keep coming and searching and inquiring. Get some books out on it. Come down to the bookshop or the bookstore down at the chaplaincy. Buy some books on it. Come and ask us questions. The question asked. Keep searching, because if he is who John says he is the one to whom you are going to deal on the last day. For he is the judge, not just of mankind, but of you. And no good saying at that point, well, I didn't think you mattered. I don't think that will carry much weight as a defense. Or I was too busy studying other things. I don't think that will carry much weight. Please keep searching. But if you know that he is the Son of Man, If you know that, he is the one who is pierced for you, then you start to know who I am, who you are yourself, and that you have been so released from sin in order to serve God. And this book will hold tremendous blessings and excitement for you as you learn what that will mean for each one of us. Let's pray, shall we? Thank and praise you, Father, for sending your Son into this world to die on our behalf, raising him up again as the firstborn of the dead, the owner and ruler of the world, the King of kings, the Lord of lords. Thank you for his faithfulness in bearing witness to the truth of the gospel throughout his life, even though it meant his death. Thank you for those scars whereby we can be free from sin and its consequences. Thank you, Father, for our Lord Jesus. Thank you that you have raised us up to sit with him in all power and authority. We do praise you in Jesus' name.